Pregnancy in two stories. Story number one. The octopus mama starves to death. The spider mama is eaten by her babies. In that context, human pregnancy is basically a miracle. Two people engage in basic pleasures of sexuality, they exchange biological matter in the process, and the doctors call it 40 weeks, we all know that's a lie, later, a living, breathing, eating, growing, learning human emerges. During gestation, a mother's body transforms to sustain both the fetus's life and her own. Her body entirely reorganizes itself, integrates fetal DNA, grows an entire new organ to sustain this new life, and at the end of the day, there's an entire new person. Miracle. Story number two. Even a quote-unquote healthy pregnancy starts with months of nausea, exhaustion, weakness, followed by joint and back pain, swollen feet, ankles, veins, digestive and respiratory difficulties, muscle displacement, and none of that is even considered a complication. Those are hyperemesis, gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, and that's just the list of that are survivable and only physical ones. So on top of that, we have psychological manifestations, mind fog, clumsiness, depression, insomnia, anxiety, obsessive compulsive behaviors. Human pregnancy is a catastrophe. Story number one and story number two are opposites. They are also both true. How are we supposed to make sense of it? How do we hold both wonder and terror with honor to the giver of life and dignity, this suffering and endangered individual? Now, just to be clear, women forever have been ideally living through this and making sense of it in their own ways. We're not talking tonight about some new technology. We're not asking about some pressing halachic question. So, like, what is this project? And what I would say to that is that it's not uncommon for us to look to the Torah for answers that can be found in other places, including in our own intuitions and in our own lived experiences. It just is also the case that when Jews find those answers in Torah, it feels different. It feels both divine and grounded, connected amongst community and to our unique and holy cultural heritage. It's as though someone thousands of years ago, and also someone on high, was looking out for me so that I could make meaning out of my life experiences and navigate this world with love. We do this all the time, but we don't do it enough with regards to motherhood in particular and uniquely female experiences broadly. So tonight in this talk, and in this essay, which I hope you will read, and in the book, which I am writing, which please God, some of you might be able to purchase somewhere, I'm trying to take a stab at this project, the Torah of pregnancy. In my essay, I argue that the Jewish tradition makes space for pregnancy story number one and pregnancy story number two. One, based in Parshat Tazria, addresses pregnancy in the abstract, reflecting on the miracle of how pregnancy is supposed to work in theory. Number two, based in Parshat Toldot, addresses pregnancy in the particular. This duality put forward by our tradition models an important and potentially life-saving way of thinking about the experience of pregnancy. In abstract, we can, and we even should, marvel and wonder, but we may not let those assumptions overshadow particular experiences of suffering. So let's take a look at story number one, pregnancy in the abstract, the miracle. In Parshat Tazria, we meet a woman who conceives, Isha ki Tazria. This woman is a theoretical abstraction. She does not have physical pains or emotional struggles because she is not a person. It's a reduction. That's the point. Vayikra is functioning here, as it so often does, as a purity textbook. People with these body parts sometimes get pregnant, they sometimes give birth, and the main concern in Vayikra is actually what happens after that, because her birth brings about this extensive state of impurity. But the Isha Ki Tazria, our flattened purity textbook woman, opens a midrashic door for wonder, for awe about pregnancy. And this is where we get to tell story number one without hesitation and without complication. There is no subjective experience that we need to make space for. In the essay, I go into some quite detailed examples from Vayikra Rabbah, but here's just one that's a little bit simple and that I really love. So Abba Bar Kahana says, Nohig shebe'olam im notel adam arnaki shel me'ot venotein hapel lamata. In the way of the world, if a person takes a purse of money and places the opening downward, does not the money scatter? But vahavlad sharui b'me'ei imo, but the fetus rests in its mother's womb. Vakadosh baruch hu mishamro shelo yipol v'yimot. But the Holy Blessed One guards it so that it doesn't fall down and die. Ein zeh shavach? Isn't that amazing? Like, yeah, kind of. It's kind of amazing. Over and over in Vayikra Rabbah, the rabbis ask these basic questions about the physics and biology of pregnancy with this refrain, Ein zeh shavach, isn't it praiseworthy? Isn't it awesome? When contemplated in the abstract, their perspective is basically dead on. The more we learn, even now, about the biology of pregnancy, the more astonishing and miraculous we find it to be. But the rabbis show us great sensitivity and great wisdom in choosing Tazria as the point of departure for their praise and wonder about pregnancy. In the abstract, without an endangered body or soul, yes, human pregnancy is miraculous. We can marvel at the beauty of creation and the magnificence of Creator because Tazria's abstract woman feels no pain. She survives to become Tehora. She brings a sacrifice, and we can imagine that she goes home afterwards to enjoy her happily growing family. But with that, let's turn over to story number two, Rivka's pregnancy in Parshat Toldot. The Torah is full of people who are begotten, but Rivka is the Torah's one and only pregnancy. Vayitrotzitzu habanim bekirba, which is an anagram for Rivka, by the way. Vayitrotzitzu habanim bekirba, vatomer im kein lama ze anochi. The children vayitrotzitzu inside of her, and she said, if so, why am I? The term Vayitrotzitzu is unusual. The root, ratzat, appears a dozen or so other times in Tanakh. Check out the footnotes, some of them are really great. Dictionaries suggest a basic meaning of like crush or break. But what does it mean here? And why is it in this unique form which implies repetition or reciprocity? And then also, what does it mean when she says, why am I? In answer to that second question, the Midrash in Breishit Rabbah tells this heartbreaking tale. Rabbi Yitzchak says, this teaches that our matriarch Rivka went to the doors of other women and said to them, did you suffer like this when you were pregnant? Is this what it's normally like? If so, wow, do I wish I had never become pregnant. She's trying to figure out whether her pregnancy is typical or not. And this speaks actually to one of the many strange things about pregnancy, which is that health feels like illness, making it extremely difficult to recognize actual illness. And it also speaks to the silence. People don't talk about the hardship, so it's very difficult to know what's normal hard and what's too hard. Some commentators, like Rashi and Sforno, they imagine that Rivka was actually having a normal-ish pregnancy, but that even then it was horrible. Others, like Ibn Ezra, think that Rivka's pregnancy was unusually hard, which seems pretty aligned with the idea that she was carrying twins. And the Bechor Shor and the Ramban, they focus more on Rivka's mental state. The Ramban puts forward this devastating, heartbreaking read. He says, what does Rivka mean when she says, if so, why am I? She means, Im keni hiya li lama ze anochi ba'olam. If this is what's going to be for me, why do I exist in the world? Halavai eneni she'amut o shelo hayiti. I wish I were dead or that I had never been born. According to the Ramban, Rivka's pregnancy is so difficult that she experiences suicidal ideation. She hopes for her own demise. With that, let's go back to our question about the word ratzatz vayitrotzitzu, crushing. The Torah describes Rivka's pregnancy as these concentric circles of crushing. So the boys within her are crushing each other. She experiences crushing physical pain as a result of their violent activity, and then her emotional suffering in response to it all crushes her will to live. This is the second story about pregnancy, Vayitrotzitzu. Several commentaries debate the details, they debate the extent, but they agree that Rivka's pregnancy is no physiological wonder. It is a catastrophe. But within that catastrophe, Rivka has the wherewithal to go and demand help from God. Vatelach lidrosh et Hashem. And in return, she receives prophecy, information, and care. So let's put it all together. The differences between the Midrashic discussions about the abstract pregnancy in Tazria versus the commentator's investigation of Rivka's particular pregnancy in Toldot, I think those differences are instructive. Yes, pregnancy in the abstract is fully a wonder and a miracle in zat shavach. And at the same time, the actual lived experience is much more varied and not infinitely catastrophic. There are appropriate times and spaces to tell both stories. Rivka was failed by a world that did not tell true stories about pregnancy. She had to go around and find them for herself. But the way her story has been preserved and forefronted in our tradition serves as an essential corrective. Now, through her, story number two has become Torah. The next time that someone suffers in pregnancy, she can read about Rivka and feel hope that there might be divine help for her as well. Importantly, in our interpretive tradition of the Rivka story, not God, not the Midrash, nor our traditional commentators attempt to dismiss or paper over Rivka's experience. Nobody talks down to her, nobody tells her how beautiful her experience is supposed to be, and nobody marvels that babies haven't fallen out. The Midrash never tells Rivka, even after 20 years of infertility, in zat shavach, not once, which is the refrain from Vayikra Rabbah. Instead, Rivka merits divine intervention and prophetic care. Story number one does have a place, though. Pregnancy, the growth of new human life, is a miracle. And there's a place to contemplate that, which is biology class, a Beit Midrash, studying the abstract Isha Ki Tazria. And sometimes, rarely, it happens that the lived experience of pregnancy is in fact this idyllic dream fulfillment. And you know what? The Torah has a space for that. Pregnancy here is a model, I want to say, for just about every human experience. When discussed in the abstract, we can speak statistically, we can theorize, make normative statements, but when there's an actual real life person involved, there's no one way that they're supposed to feel. A pregnant person might feel like a miraculous partner in creation, or they might feel like death. Or, most likely at all, a person might just feel all of it at once. But which story are they going to tell? And the truth of the matter is that the stories of our lives are really messy. But what we share determines the limits of our ability to see and be seen, to give and receive care. The bottom line is that our stories must be told with sensitivity in the proper places and times, with room for the miraculous to be catastrophic and the catastrophic to be miraculous. Thank you. So there's a treat in store for all of us now, which is that we get to learn Torah from my chavrusa and friend in life and in Torah, Rav Tali Adler, and I might contribute a few things.
First of all, I love that this is happening right now. I remember during my last pregnancy, a text that I got from you saying, Tali, guess who the first person to experience pregnancy in Tanakh is? And I imagine that what was going on at that point was the roots of this. And to that, I'd love it if you could speak to us a little bit about where did this essay come from? Where was it, not to pun too heavily, conceived? How did it develop?
In my first position out of Maharat, I was working at a synagogue in Chicago, Anshe Shalom B'nai Israel congregation in the Lakeview neighborhood. And we had like a shmillion young families. There was approximately a baby born like every day. And we wanted to have more women's Torah learning like programming. And so I thought, what could be more fun for that than to teach? Brooke, I actually taught a proto version of it at the Hebrew Institute of White Plains to teach Torah, like uterus Torah, like all this like funky, there's so much like amazing Torah about what happens in the uterus. And like, you never hear like drushes about it. And it's fiber Torah, right? So I was like, we'll learn that together. And the response was like really interesting. It was much more, I had never experienced pregnancy at that time. The response was much more interesting than I had anticipated. So I was sort of holding in these texts, and then I think that we moved from Chicago to Philly, the shul that we belong to and love very, very much, Kilat Shari Orah in Philly, the lay people give Divrei Torah, and I at the time was a layperson in the shul, and I was signed up for Parshat Toldot, and I was reading through the Rivka story, and I had just kind of I had a baby at the time, and I was like, these ideas really, like, they're really different. This is a really different message, and so the proto version of this essay actually was delivered as a sermon at that time. With really a lot of the same sort of messaging about how no one ever tells Rivka, like, no, don't forget, your pregnancy is a miracle. Like, that was the real kind of thrust of it then. And since then I've become, and we can talk about this more also, like, very, very interested in pregnancy.
I'm thinking now that if someone had come to me with the Vayikra text while I was pregnant, exactly as you said, it probably would have made me at least mildly irritated, let's say that. Mm-hmm. But what you do is you present this idea of actually when it's read as a both and, there's something incredibly redemptive about that. What was it that let you hold on to that, okay, there's something here in the Vayikra Rabbah text, instead of kind of saying, that is incredibly irritating and I'm putting it to the
I think because I like already had a relationship with it, maybe. and I wasn't, you know, and it's just so like funny. And at the time when I had taught it to all of these people who had experienced pregnancy, the reaction wasn't like rage. It was like, I have those same questions, actually. I also want to know how it fits inside and like what it's doing all day and like why it doesn't fall out. And that to me was like actually this very sort of beautiful reflection. Because a lot of times when you read sort of like sciencey stuff in the Midrash, you're like, LOL, we know the answer to that. And like, that's not really true about pregnancy. Like, we don't really know the answer to it. Because you're not supposed to study pregnant people. But there's, okay, more on that a different time. There's just a lot that we don't actually understand and we don't actually know. And so I think that, you know, being able to really hang on to that wonder, and even if we did have the answers, honestly, like, one of the things I always think about is that when we think we don't know anything about pregnancy, like, imagine a world without blood tests, without ultrasounds, without genetic testing, without a million things, right? Like, it was just all you had was, like, my baby's moving, my baby's not moving. So that, like, the baby starting to move was considered, like, a new phase of pregnancy. It was called the quickening in English. Because that's kind of all the feedback you got. Like, are you growing? I mean, we still measure growth as like a metric on the outside, which is weird. So I think that like you have to keep the space for wonder. You just have to contextualize the wonder and make sure you're trying to hand it to someone who's feeling it.
Let's go from the Bayerka text for a moment back to the Rivka text. You do an amazing job in the essay, I think, of articulating, okay, here's what it might mean emotionally for a person going through pregnancy, particularly a difficult pregnancy, to find the Rivka text. But Rivka has something that we don't have, right? Rivka ends with a pronouncement from God, which the Ramban that you said in your essay says, and she was comforted and her soul was quieted. I'm wondering, for those of us who don't have that, who don't have the opportunity to experience prophecy, for those of you who do, I'm very happy for you. Where do we find ourselves in that?
Yeah, but I think it's also, I love that she demanded prophecy. Like, to me, that's actually such a powerful thing. And it speaks to the power of prayer for a pregnant person, which I think is like a really important piece of the prophecy model. An idea that Rav Soloveitchik, amongst others, writes about is that, you know, when we learn Torah, God speaks to us, and when we pray, we kind of reciprocate, right? We speak back to God. And I do think that there's actually both sides of a conversation happening with Rivka. Like, the Midrash imagines she, like, bangs down the doors of a Beit Midrash to, like, receive almost like an oracle, which is not the way prophecy usually happens, certainly not for women. There's something about that demand that we can channel. We have tools. I would say that every genetic test and every ultrasound, first of all, like, I personally really believe that medicine is miraculous and that medical technologies are miraculous and that the invention of those technologies are the revealed hand of God in this world. That for me feels like scratching at prophecy. The second thing that I would say about that is that part of what Rivka's demanding is not just divine intervention, but information. And actually, a piece of the information that she did not have was that she was carrying twins, which explains a lot of her experience. And the second piece of information, which the Bechor Shor writes about, is that she thought, wow, I davened for this. Everyone davened for me to have this pregnancy, and I wanted this pregnancy for 20 years, and now I'm losing it. Like, she's worried about pregnancy loss, actually, in the Bechor Shor's. And today, when people are worried, am I losing this pregnancy, you actually see doctors managing that in quite specific ways, either through, like, this is a manifestation of anxiety that we can address in various, whether through medication or through other types of like therapeutic interventions. But also, when you have someone who's had a loss or maybe a series of losses, those people can get extra ultrasounds, extra information, extra reassurance. And our medical like world today does actually kind of offer, or at least potentially offer, that type of reassurance that Rivka gets from God.
I want to follow up on what the idea you just put out there about, yeah, God kind of has sort of genetic testing ultrasounds for Rivka, tells her what's going on there. A difference that strikes me between what God does there and what modern medicine does is the news that Rivka actually gets is actually a fairly bad genetic result, right? You have these two children who are going to be at war for the rest of your life, for the rest of their lives. Not every mother's dream. But God actually contextualizes it in a way that says, okay, and there's meaning there. Mm-hmm. In a world where modern medicine isn't going to do that, I want to go back to the where do we find God in this question? Where do you want people to look when they get those not great results to try to make meaning?
Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult, and it's obviously so difficult to tell any individual how they are supposed to make meaning. My experience with this is that some people are immediately like, I want to learn all the Torah. Where is the meaning? How do I move forward from this? What happens next? I can't wait until this is part of a bigger narrative that I get to tell about my family. And some people just want to experience the loss and the break in their lives with the humongous questions that come along with that. Why me? Why this baby? Why this community? Why am I surrounded by babies on Shabbat and not me? And everyone deals with that so differently. It's hard to kind of make any sort of proclamations about how one could or should. There is a great book about pregnancy loss by Rabbi Avraham Stav called, in Hebrew it's Kachalom Ya'uf, but it just came out in English, I believe, called As a Fleeting Dream, maybe? As a Fleeting Dream, yeah. And there's some really great material in there, so I would direct people in that direction, for sure. Some people in that direction.
I wanted, Becca, you actually pointed out two different spots where Rivka goes banging on doors, right? There's the banging on the door of, in at least some midrashic tellings, the big midrash, okay, I'm coming here to get answers. And there's the banging on the doors of her neighbors, her friends, is this what it was like for you? How does this compare to what you experienced? I guess what I'm wondering about is, what is there in the Rivka story for people who may not have the energy or the willpower in those moments to go banging on doors?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a hope that Rivka banged on doors and then they opened for everyone. And that's obviously not exactly the case, as we've already described. You know, she banged on doors and received miraculous information that we don't quite have access to, not in the way that she did, at least. But I think in terms of that storytelling, I mean, a piece of it that we've really seen just happen now, like just really recently in our generation, we've really overcome the silence about pregnancy loss. I think people talk about that so much more than any of our parents ever did, surely. And people are much more honest with their friends about their pregnancy experiences and their birth experiences and their postpartum experiences. And I think that is continuing the work of Rivka. I think that's really in line with this idea of, like, doors need to be knocked on and stories need to be told, and they need to be told not just because it's good for you to tell your own story, which it is, but also because other people need to hear it so that when it happens to them, they'll be able to say, oh, I know what's happening. This happened to Rav Tali. I know what's happening. This happened to Leia. Like, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, and she's walking around now, so like that seems okay.
The Rivka story is just about Rivka. Yitzchak isn't there. Can you speak a little bit about what you think happens to Yitzchak? Why isn't he there? And if there is actually a way for couples to learn this Torah as couples, even though she seems to be acting as an individual there?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So Tikva Farmer Kensky writes about this in her writing about Rivka, and she has really not great things to say about Yitzchak, and they're pretty compelling. Right, so it starts out, Vayetar Yitzchak Lenochach Isho. When one of Eva Zornberg writes about that Vayetar, she describes it as like a laser beam. She says, Yitzchak is the only one of the patriarchs who's monogamous. All of his energy gets directed at his wife, and the Midrash imagines them lying there together saying, like, davening to have children. I want children only from, like, this tzaddikah. Like, it's such a beautiful Midrash that imagines just this very loving partnership. But the minute she gets pregnant, she's kind of on her own, meaning Yitzchak's atirot came true. His prayers came true. Exactly as he dreamed of them, in multiples even, right? Like, insta family, right? And for Rivka, like, she feels betrayed. That's what I think the Sforno, I have it on here, writes about that really explicitly. Yeah, she says, right? Lama zehit av kraisha, source 6. Shaya ni im hazara. Why did my relatives want this for me? Right? They said the minute when her family sends her off with Eved Avraham, they pray, achotenu at hiyila alfei revava, right? Which means, like, have lots of children, right? And why did my husband, v'chein ba'ali shit palel alai bazen, my husband also daven, she feels so betrayed by everywhere she came from, right? Her first identity is Bat Betuel Anochi, I am Betuel's daughter. This is what my family wanted for me. And then she, right, you leave that identity and she moves into Sarah's tent. Her husband loves her and that's so nice. And now she has this new identity, also kind of male-centered. And he lets her down too. Everyone led me to think this is what was good for me. And it turns out it's horrible. So, and Yitzchak is not with her, or at least he doesn't appear to be with her in that. And what Tikva Farmer Kensky writes is that it's really obvious from the fact that when they were trying to get pregnant, Yitzchak, who's the shaliach tzibor of the family, and And when it goes poorly, she's on her own. That shift is very painful. It's meant to be very obvious, and it's meant to be very painful. And you hear from Yitzhak again after they're born. So at the very end of the story, right after the babies are born, Yitzhak comes back. Yitzhak ben shishim shana beledet otam. Right? Yitzhak is now 60 when they're born. But the pregnancy, he has nothing to do with. And her struggles, he has nothing to do with. There's a blindness there. There's a real, and Yitzhak will someday, of course, become blind. And I sort of wonder whether his inability to see the world around him is a foreshadowing of his inability then to see his children as well. But he starts by not being able to see his wife. And I think that that's devastating. I think it's where this marriage starts to fall apart, where she starts to realize I'm on my own to manifest this destiny. And then ultimately that's a lesson well learned when she really takes that to the next level by tricking her husband. So I think it all, you know, we see some loving scenes in between here and there, but I think there's like a real lesson learned here that when the times are tough, I'm in charge. And you don't really want to feel that way in a marriage, and especially not during a pregnancy where I think something we talked about is like, right, this is something I talk about a lot with Ethan, hello. It's like our home is so equal and so egalitarian, and like guess what's not egalitarian at all? Gestation, like breastfeeding.
There is no number of diapers that will ever make up for all those hours.
Not any number, in fact. And that's really hard, actually. It's like insurmountable. And the idea then that not only are you not pregnant along with me, but that also you don't even see me. You're not even with me in it. And so part of me wishes, like, if a pregnancy is going in a challenging way, or someone wants to just feel seen in the, like, quote-unquote normal challenges of pregnancy, like, I would almost wish, like, the gestating partner reads this text and tells her spouse how she feels about it, you know? Like, that she's actually, like, almost a piece of the Torah, and that it could be a practice of, like, I'm going to be the not Yitzhak in this marriage.
I was wondering, you're obviously reading this text of Rivka's pregnancy through the how might pregnant people see themselves in this text. But one of the ways we refer to Rivka very often is Rivka Imenu. We think of her as a mother figure. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about what is it like to read this text, not just as someone who's a mother, but someone who's the child of a mother who went through pregnancy.
Yeah. Well, and I think that even going through pregnancy yourself, like not even like reading this text, but just going, you can't appreciate what someone did for you until you are doing it for them. Like the idea that every single human who walks this earth for the first bunch of months of their lives, somebody was a week every like 2 to 3 hours with them is astonishing. Like, that, it is insane that there exist humans. And I think that like you can't imagine like the level of just love and care that was poured into just your existing, like just surviving the first like 4-6 months of life. Like you don't remember it, you know? Like the only way you learn about what someone must surely have done for you is by paying it forward in this, like, really brutal way.
Which again speaks to the loneliness your child can't possibly understand until one day.
Yeah.
You mentioned at the beginning the book. I wasn't going to let you go without talking about the book. You found here two different stories of pregnancy, one of which you say, I think beautifully, is a story that we just don't tell often enough, not in our Torah lives and not in our regular lives. What are the other stories of pregnancy, motherhood that we don't talk about enough? What are the chapters that you're excited to write about?
The motherhood discourse in the world today is very like my way or the highway. If you give a child formula, they will not go to college. Like, if you have an epidural, like, you will die and so will your baby. Like, just, it's very intense. Like, and
counting their points right now, by the way.
And, right, it's just like this super like intense, extremist in every way kind of language. And I think the intervention that the Torah has to offer is the multivocality. And there's so many Torah texts that people never learned. Every single life transition is marked ritually and through Torah. You become a person, mazel tov, you have a bris or a simchat bat now, thank God. Like, you become an adult, wow, you have a bar mitzvah, you have a bat mitzvah, you get married, you're going to do some real learning, and that transition's going to be marked ritually. You got divorced, that's going to be marked ritually. You die, like, your family's going to process intensely, and as you're dying, if you're lucky, that might be also accompanied by some real ritual. But the piece of life that gets no ritual and no accompaniment and no learning is matrescence. And we can even like say that also, I don't know if there's a word called patrescence, but it deserves to be a word also, the becoming of parents. And you spend all your time being like, which stroller should I buy? Which crib should I buy? If you're smart, you've read some books about infant sleep, but you have not read any books about what it means to completely transform your life in preparation for having something that completely depends on you in every single possible way. And that's bonkers. And all the information out there, as I said, is in a lot of ways problematic because it doesn't allow, like it's so like fiercely, orthodox maybe is like the word I'm hesitant to use about it, that it doesn't allow for other experiences, other needs, the complexities of just like being a person in this world. And I think what the Torah really has to offer is like, pregnancy is awesome, pregnancy is death. Breastfeeding is amazing, God did it to the Jewish people in the desert with the manna. Breastfeeding is a household chore that you can outsource, right? Both of those things are held within Torah. That's not like, those are not like, oh, like weird side ideas. Those are very mainstream ideas that are in some ways opposite and totally honored, right? Like, we can actually honor everyone doing within reason things that are right for them all in one book. So that's kind of the idea. Like, a pregnancy is awesome, pregnancy is terrible. Breastfeeding is the best thing that could ever happen to your kid. Breastfeeding is not necessary, and there's lots of great alternatives. And the Gemara already understands a world where formula feeding is wrapped up in shame and criticism intensely. Right? Abaye says, like, you're killing children with your shame, which is amazing. Like, that's what I'm saying. These texts exist. No one studies them. And how transformative could it be for someone if they did? So that's the book project. The dream is, like, it'll be written in these little short bites so that you can, like, read it during all the waiting, like, in doctor's offices and whatever. So hopefully, and then also there's, like, a halacha section because Shabbos, when you bring home a baby, is, like, wild. So there's that also.
You spoke about the kind of, these are the stories that people need when they're entering this period, the non-existing rituals that we probably need in this new becoming. And I'm wondering, what did it feel like for you to have to write your own Torah for this that didn't exist when you marked that? Was that difficult? Was it empowering? What did that feel like?
Yeah, so my first thing on this is like 10 out of 10 do not recommend having your first child in April 2020. So that was just like an incredibly like lonely and disorienting time for everyone. And then add Cyrus into the mix. So for me, it was a time like bringing our first baby home was this incredibly disorienting and really profoundly scary time because we'd been in the hospital, so like we couldn't accept any help from anyone for fear that they would die in the process. Do you remember April 2020? And that really felt like the isolation of that felt very scary. Mara Benjamin's book had just come out, which taught me that when you have a baby, the baby replaces God. That was also very scary. Very rarely have academic books like caused real trauma to me, but that one. For like a program that I was in at the time, I read Marjorie Lehman has this amazing collection called Motherhood and the Jewish Cultural Imagination. And over Shavuos, my baby was born. Hey, ER. So that gives you a sense of like, it was approximately the Omer later. I read that book, and all of a sudden I was just like flooded. I felt like, wow, I'm getting pastoral care from like an academic collection of essays. I actually wrote Marjorie Lehman a letter afterwards being like, I think you saved me. And I just realized that like what I needed was connection. What I needed was to feel like, wow, this is an incredibly lonely time, but like I am not alone because like Rivka did this, you know? Like Jewish women have been doing this since forever, and there's Torah and there's wisdom that can hold and support and really offer a lifeboat in a time that is like so scary because you don't know who you are or what your life is anymore.
Thank you so much, Leah. Let's transition to some of the questions from the audience. Someone here was hedging a little. They said most, and then in parentheses above the word most, all these texts, male perspectives. How do you see the limits of these sources in seeing women?
Great. So as you might have noticed while I've been talking, I've tried to like mention as many women as I can fit in my mouth. And this is something that like our generation, I'm looking at all my like Maharat colleagues here, especially we as a community have talked about a lot, which is like these texts are our heritage, right? So like the Torah was written by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have a gender. But it was carried in vessels created by humans, and those humans are often men. So what do we understand about what's inside of those vessels and outside of those vessels? What's the created part of those vessels, and what's the honest part of those vessels? And particularly for us, I think it's like, what does it mean for us to become the vessels? And as inheritors and inheritors of a tradition who really believe in teaching Torah b'shem Umro and in the name of the one who said it and in carrying it down through a Masorah that was mostly carried in explicit ways, at least by men, for a very long time, it's a big honor to be amongst the first two generations of women who are vessels of this material, and to be able to contribute our own voices. And when we think about ourselves as those transformative but holding, what ideally kind of, you know, boar seed kind of and mayan mikaver vessels, there's like two models. Sorry, that was a little niche. There are two, forgot I'm not just talking to Tali. There are two models of Torah scholars. There's the boar seed, I mean, there's many, but two of them are boar seed, enoma ve'tufa, like the plastered pit that doesn't lose a single drop, and the mayan mikaver, which is the spring that sort of overflows with an even like new and chidush material. But both of those, right, are containers for this inherited stream of our Masorah. And so on the one hand, like I like to imagine that like, thank God men took the time to continue to hold this Torah so that we could receive it and get it to where it needs to go.
Another men question. This is interesting. Are there any paradigmatic examples of quote unquote good male spouses, fathers, life partners, which contrast with Yitzhak? So we can have our
That is a great question that I probably need to think about more than I can at this moment. But I'm open to suggestions. Do you have any ideas? Do you have ideas?
You know, it occurs to me that there's some, you know, about this commentary that I'm obsessed with on the Rivka story.
Yes.
It says that it's a late Tosfos commentary, and it says that this might not be a life partner answer, but it argues that what Rivka is actually seeking when she goes L'Josh Hashem is she's seeking permission, halachic permission to get an abortion. Because she's suffering so much. And she kind of knocks down the door of the Beit Midrash, and the Tosfos asks, why does it say she went to the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever? She has a perfectly good halachist as a father-in-law, Abraham. The answer given is it's not safe to go to Abraham. It's not safe to go to Abraham because he's too embroiled in this. And I think part of what the Midrash is doing there is that Tosafist commentary is doing there is actually creating, if not in Yitzchak, who's absent from the story, these other two figures of Shem Ve'Ever who are willing to listen and hear and give Rivka an honest halachic answer and not let their biases get in the way. And I wonder if there's something redemptive there and a bit of a model of, okay, what does a kind of worthy companion, even if it's not a life companion in that moment, look like?
Yeah. The other thing that just comes to mind is, so the other pregnancy that appears in the Torah, like, that takes up any time, right? We have a lot of, like, vatahar vateled, right? Like, she gets pregnant, she gave birth, great. The other person whose pregnancy spans any amount of time is Hagar. We don't know anything about her pregnancy, but we know that while she's pregnant, she's expelled and comes back. And interestingly, it seems like Avraham wants to be attentive to Hagar in this time, but then gets divine intervention to, like, not be. So I don't know quite what, like, that's also very painful and difficult, and the divine intervention, that story, right? Anyone named Sarah really loves that story. But actually, I think from a, what does it mean to be a spouse? But I mean, whatever, having two wives, always complicated, apparently. So I don't know quite what to make of that, but there's, like, something there that should be thrown into the hopper.
Someone asks, is there any significance to this being Rivka's only pregnancy? She doesn't have an easier one later to, quote-unquote, make up for this hard one. What do you make of that?
Oh, I mean, it might reflect on what happens to her in Yitzhak's marriage.
Oh, wow.
And you know that because, so Rivka has an analog in the character of Tamar, who's the other mother of twins. And it seems like Tamar and Yudah never have sex again. If you want to read it back into the, and they also have all those same elements of trickery and whatever. There's a lot going on between those two stories, obviously. If you then want to, like, read it backwards into the Rivka story, like, you could see that. It's a little bit difficult because they get kind of spotted fooling around. So that's, like, not, like, the best possible read, but you don't know exactly what they're doing, what they're willing to do outside. Like, I don't know. Anyways, lots of questions.
There's also the, it occurs to me there's a midrash that says Rivka basically said, that says, yeah, Rivka was supposed to be the mother of all the 12 Shvatim, and she says, no, I am not doing it. I got it, and God says, yeah, that is fine.
She had to make space for Leia.
So we studied some of these texts together way back when, and I'm curious for you to reflect a little more on Vayikra Rabbah. That has 14 different images, if I'm correct.
Yeah, there's a lot happening there.
What's happening there? And so I love what you've done with expanding the sense of, or the multivocality of the two stories in opposition to each other, the Vayikra Rabbah versus the Rivka story. But I'm actually interested inside of the Vayikra Rabbah text, how much variability there is and what you make of that.
So Tammy Jacobitz writes about this in her doctoral dissertation, which I'm sure many of you know, and it's a fantastic chapter, and everyone should read it, and she should publish it. One of the things that she writes about is that the subject is, like, totally stripped. Like, who makes pregnancy in Vayikra Rabbah? Kadosh Baruch Hu. And she really writes about the problematics of that, which I think are maybe resolved by the existence of the Rivka story, right? So when you have the Rivka story, then you just, that the Rivka story maybe is even, like, the primary story, and Vayikra Rabbah is, like, this very sensitive, like, oh, we don't want to marvel at pregnancy on Rivka, so we're going to find a different place for it, and, like, what's the optimal place to do that is this, like, totally detailless person who has reproductive or female reproductive. So, but to your question of, first of all, I would say, like, Dr. Jacobowitz's intervention and arguments are very well taken within the context of Vayikra Rabbah and certainly some of the problems that she points out there and some of the difficulties. When you read those texts, you're like, that's a person you're writing about. Like, where is she? But I do think that there are, you know, there's a lot going on there. One of the, in every Midrashic text, as I'm sure many of you know, there's, like, the main text that we're talking about, and then there's the, like, other texts that are whirling around in the background. And in Vayikra Rabbah, one of those texts is Iyov, which actually the Ramban here, I cut it out, but his source text for her suicidal ideation is also Iyov. So this, like, pregnancy Iyov thing it's very intense. Aviva Zornberg writes about it in her Murmurings of the Deep on Rivka. But it's not always, meaning in the Ramban, it's brought as this, like, suicidal ideation piece. But in Vayakaraba, it's not always, right? Sometimes it's like the infant, like there's a light and the infant uses it to like see to Spain. And like, right, it's just like this fascinating sort of, oh, it must be boring in there. Like, what are they doing all the time? Oh, isn't it dark? But the darkness kind of cuts both ways, right? Because like on the one hand, God makes a light, but on the other hand, oh, it's a prison, right? So there's, I don't know whether it's like different people, but they're definitely like playing with, or it seems like it's different people probably, but like they're certainly playing with like, oh, this is a really confined space. Like, are we in high and like that confined space is like perfect because I'm really just a brain in a vat? Or is that prison, or is that horrible and I'm contained and I'm uncomfortable? So I do think that even within like setting aside some of the critiques of Dr. Jacobowitz, we can definitely kind of find what to identify with more or less within the different images that are being played around with. The other person who writes about this is Gwyn Kessler, and she has a book called Conceiving Israel. Lots of women adding their voices to our Masorah on the subject.
Thank you so much for putting this Torah up.
Thank you.